while they're all waiting for Israel and Palestinians to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that's going nowhere, in the meantime, they're facing a common threat. And eventually, the common threat from Iran took precedence over their fealty to Palestinian nationalism.
Welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Ferran Sosilia. Today on the podcast, we will be discussing the long history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, as well as recent normalization agreements between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors. What has traditionally driven this complicated relationship? What role has the United States played in attempting to resolve the conflict? And how can the region build on new normalization and security agreements to improve the long-term stability of the Middle East? To answer these questions and more, we're joined today by Ambassador Martin Indyk. Ambassador Indyk is the Distinguished Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. From February 2015 to March 2018, he served as Executive Vice President of the Brookings Institution. During his tenure in government, Ambassador Indyk served as U.S. Special Envoy for the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations from July 2013 to June 2014, and as U.S. Ambassador to Israel from 1995 to 1997, and again from 2000 to 2001. We're very excited to have him joining us today, and we hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. Thank you for joining us today, Ambassador.
Thank you for having me.
For decades, the Arab-Israeli conflict has been one of the most contentious, divisive, and geopolitically significant areas in international relations. So to begin this episode, could you provide to our listeners a brief overview of where the animosity between Arab states in the Middle East and Israel stemmed from originally?
So the original conflict was between Jews and Arabs in Palestine, the historic area that became the British Mandate of Palestine after the First World War. But before the war, Jews had been coming in to settle and live there as part of the Zionist dream of returning to their homeland, their ancient homeland from biblical times, 2,000 years earlier. And that effort to fulfill the dream of Zion was resisted in some cases more, in some cases less, by the local inhabitants, the Palestinians. And so there was a struggle over land, land ownership, land use, under the British mandate after the First World War. That struggle intensified, and it was also a struggle with the British, who were the kind of colonial overseers. The Arab states saw the growing Zionist movement at first as not a particular threat, but once it became a state back in 1948, the Arab states also were concerned that this would be a disruptive influence in their midst. The idea of a Jewish state was something which they found threatening as Muslim and Arab states. And some saw it as a kind of extension of Western imperialism, since Israel is essentially a creation of the West, although the Soviet Union played an important role in early days to try to get rid of the British from that area, actually quite successfully. So, in other words, the tension came and conflict came from the interaction of Jewish national aspirations for a state of their own and their ancient homeland, and Palestinian aspirations for to stay in the land, as it were. Didn't start with national aspirations, but developed into national aspirations. And so the Israeli-Palestinian conflict became part of a broader Arab-Israeli conflict after Israel was established in 1948 and the Arab states refused to recognize it and launched war on it. Five Arab states surrounding Israel launched war to try to do away with the state of Israel at birth. And that Arab-Israeli conflict continued with outbreaks of war. There was the War of Independence in 1948, the Suez Crisis of 1956, which Israel and Egypt went to war with Israel having British and French support. And then the Six-Day War of 1967, in which Israel preempted what looked like an intention of the Arab armies of Egypt, Syria, and Jordan to invade Israel under the leadership of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Egyptian president, who was threatening to destroy Israel and mobilizing his troops and kicking out the UN emergency forces that had been put in there back in 56. And so in the Six-Day War, as it became known, because it took 6 days for Israel to defeat all of the Arab armies and occupy the Sinai Peninsula between Egypt and Israel, the West Bank and Jerusalem on the Jordanian front, and the Golan Heights with Syria. And so that war left Israel in occupation of a large amount of Egyptian territory, a highly sensitive and symbolic Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. They'd already had control of West Jerusalem, but it took control of East Jerusalem, and then on the Golan Heights with Syria. And so Israel suddenly found itself in a situation of occupying Arab land, giving it room to breathe, what the Israelis thought was secure borders, definitely weren't recognized. But it also in the process gave the Arabs an even greater grievance against Israel because now their territory had been occupied and they wanted it back. 1973, October, Yom Kippur War was a surprise attack on two fronts. Egypt and Syria launched surprise attacks against Israel, again, to try to regain their territory by force with the backing of the Soviet Union. And that's when we had a kind of major crisis that escalated into a superpower crisis before that war ended, after I think it was 16 days. In that war, once the ceasefire was struck, Egypt regained a strip of land on the east of the Suez Canal in the Sinai Peninsula. Syria lost more land, actually. The Israeli army was like 40 kilometers from Damascus when the fighting stopped. But that then launched an American-led peace process to try to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. And the big breakthrough there was the agreements, the first disengagement agreements that Henry Kissinger, as Secretary of State, negotiated. That was followed by a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, in which Egypt regained all of the Sinai Peninsula that it had lost to Israel in the 67 Six-Day War. And that set the precedent for the Arabs that there could be return of territory, all of Egyptian territory that had been occupied by Israel. But the price was peace with Israel, peace and normalization of Israel, with Israel, recognition of Israel, and security arrangements with Israel to stabilize the peace. So that was essentially the precedent. But it took a long time for Jordan then to join. In the meantime, the Israelis and Palestinians struck a framework agreement, the Oslo Accords. But Jordan made a peace treaty with Israel in 1994. So something like 12 years after the Israeli-Egypt peace treaty, And then came the Abraham Accords in 2020. So you see a long historic span of conflict leading and wars leading eventually to peace agreements between Israel and Egypt, Israel and Jordan, Israel and Syria. The United States negotiated, I was involved in that in great detail, an Israeli-Syrian agreement, and we missed it, unfortunately, for all sorts of untoward reasons, but the basic outlines of a territory for peace deal were established in the Clinton administration, and then there were some negotiations continued after that. The basic deal with Syria was there. The Israeli-Palestinian negotiation became a little more complicated, and we can get into that if you like, but in essence, that agreement never came to fruition for a two-state solution, as it's called, because instead of advancing towards peace, there was a major blow-up, Palestinian uprising, Israeli response, thousands were killed, destroying all the trust. And as a result, we have where we are today, with essentially peace with most Arab countries, or the potential for peace being there, with most Arab countries, and yet a real stalemate between the Israelis and Palestinians.
Ambassador Indyk, before we come to the present times, I want to provide a little bit more context to our listeners by asking you a second question regarding the history of this conflict. As we just discussed, it seems that the last major war between Arab states and Israel was in 1973, not counting the wars in Lebanon. So from then to recent years, what has prevented the amelioration of Arab-Israeli relations? And on the flip side, how has trust been built since then to allow a lot of these agreements to be signed, especially after the Sinai interim agreement?
Yeah, well, the agreements that were originally negotiated between Israel and Egypt and Israel and Syria, which is the subject of my recent book, which Henry Kissinger negotiated when he was Secretary of State, were essentially designed to do two things. First of all, to separate the warring armies after the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and therefore stabilize the situation, and then go on from there to take incremental steps towards a final peace agreement in which Israel would withdraw from parts of the territory that it occupied in return for security arrangements. The net effect of that, of those two Israeli Egyptian agreements and one between Israel and Syria, was to take Egypt out of the conflict with Israel. A large buffer created in the Sinai, but it essentially created circumstances in which it would be very difficult for Egypt to go back to war. Now, Egypt is the largest, militarily most powerful Arab state. Once it was out of the conflict, no other Arab state could really contemplate going to war with Israel, and no other Arab state did so. And 2 years after that, President Jimmy Carter negotiated a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, which confirmed this approach of taking Egypt out of the conflict. And even though Egypt was excoriated by the other Arab states for having made peace with Israel at the time, nevertheless, the other Arab states were unable to contemplate going back to war in order to get the territory that Israel held back. And so they had to instead engage in peace negotiations under American auspices, because Sadat had shown and they had come to accept that it was only the United States that could deliver territorial concessions from Israel. So Sadat used to say to his people, I'm going to Washington because Washington gives Israel everything from a loaf of bread to a Phantom jet. The Phantom jet was the F-35s in those days. And that was his argument. Basically, it's the United States that can deliver Israel, nobody else can. And that remains true to this day, even though the United States has really tarnished its credibility over the last 20 years for a host of reasons. Nevertheless, Arabs, Palestinians, as much as they decry America's support for Israel and backing of Israel, nevertheless look to the United States in order to try to get their territory back from Israel.
Let's dig deeper into the critical role that the United States has played in the Arab-Israeli conflict since 1973, the subject of your book, Master of the Game. I would like to know what has been the American approach to resolving the Arab-Israeli conflict. What did Henry Kissinger do back in 1973 to deliver those first Sinai interim agreements? And what has been the American approach to the conflict since?
So before Kissinger came along, the basic approach of the United States was, after the 67 Six-Day War, was essentially to join up with the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union was the patron of the major Arab states, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, and join up with the Soviet Union and impose a settlement on the parties where Israel would be pressed to return to the pre-67 lines, give up all the territory it had occupied, as we discussed, and would receive peace in return from the Arabs. And that's what the United States tried to do before the Yom Kippur War, before Kissinger came along, and never got anywhere with that. Israel wasn't prepared to withdraw, and the Arabs weren't prepared to make peace with Israel, and so it didn't go anywhere. The 73 war created a plastic moment in which both sides, having gone to war, having suffered the human consequences of a large-scale war, were more willing to consider an effort to resolve the conflict. And that's when Kissinger entered the game. But Kissinger's approach, unlike those who had come before him, and I should say unlike those who came after him as well, decided that it didn't make sense to try to go for the whole enchilada, as the United States had previously tried to do. But rather, he introduced an incremental approach, what he called step-by-step diplomacy, in which Israel would take small steps of withdrawal, smaller steps of withdrawal, and the Arabs would reciprocate with security arrangements that would have the effect of ameliorating the conflict, stabilizing the situation, and then the peace process under American auspices could go on, take another step and another step, leading eventually to non-belligerency agreements and then to peace agreements. But Kissinger believed that that process of reconciliation, as opposed to amelioration, reconciliation in which the Arabs decided to end the conflict and end their claims and make peace with Israel and normalize relations with Israel, and Israel agreed to withdraw completely from Arab territory it had occupied in 1967, Kissinger believed that process would take a long time. He didn't expect to see it in his lifetime. He felt that the Arabs would only come to terms with Israel after they exhausted themselves and exhausted the other options. And that in the meantime, Israel had to be strengthened with US support so that when eventually the Arabs came to accept Israel and decided to end their conflict, Israel would be in a position of strength to give up their territory, the Arab territory it had occupied, at which point peace would prevail. But that was something he saw would take decades. And of course, he was wrong about Egypt. And had he had a different perspective and had been willing to take more risks, he could have gotten a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. As I show in the documentation, Sadat was ready, and Yitzhak Rabin, who was prime minister first time around back in the 1970s, was also ready. Even Assad of Syria seemed to be ready. But it was Kissinger who kept on putting the brakes on, saying, no, that's not worth the paper it's written on. You can't end this conflict. That'll take forever. Let's just try to take another small step. And yet Jimmy Carter came along with that same instinct that I described before the 73 war of American presidents who wanted to resolve the conflict. And he went at it and, lo and behold, got a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt 2 years after Kissinger left office. That was not the timetable that Kissinger expected at all. And yet, Carter was able to achieve it because Kissinger had been wrong. He'd been wrong about Sadat. Sadat was ready to end the conflict. And he'd been wrong about the Israelis who were ready to give up all of the Sinai. And that was done by a right-wing leader, Menachem Begin. So there's been this tension in American diplomacy ever since between the Kissingerian, cautious, conservative, incremental approach and the more radical, ambitious, even zealous approaches of most presidents since then, including Donald Trump, Barack Obama, certainly Bill Clinton, who wanted to end the conflict, wanted to resolve it with a final peace deal. And the difference is that while Jimmy Carter succeeded, with the exception of the Israel-Jordan peace treaty that Bill Clinton negotiated, all the others failed. And we haven't been able to make peace between Israel, Syria, Israel, Lebanon, or of course, Israel and the Palestinians.
And Ambassador Indyk, what is the reason for that? Why has peace eluded the Reagan administration, Bush senior administration, Bush junior and Barack Obama and Donald Trump?
And Bill Clinton.
And Bill Clinton, of course, yes.
There are a lot of reasons. The ones that I focus on and think are critical here is that Kissinger was right in the sense that other than Sadat, for a very long time, the other Arabs were not ready. We tested the proposition with Assad of Syria, Hafez al-Assad, the father of the current leader. And he actually was ready at the end of the Clinton administration. He played around with us for 8 years, but at the end of the Clinton administration, he was ready, but it was a kind of ships passing in the night. Barak, the Israeli leader, did not feel he had the support of the Israeli people to make a full withdrawal from the Golan in exchange for full peace. And so when Assad was ready, Barak was not. And then Assad was dying, so he shifted focus to putting his son in power, unfortunately, for the Syrian people. And 3 months later, when Barak was ready for a full withdrawal from the Golan, it was too late for Assad. And so it was really literally, when one side was ready and the other was not, the other side was ready first side was not, and we missed it. And then Syria descended into civil war. So that's been very difficult. But the heart of the problem has been reconciling Israelis and Palestinians. And that's because, as I described it at the beginning, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians was much more about the land that Israel and the Palestinians lived on. This is a fundamental territorial dispute between two peoples. There was no dispute that Israel had occupied the Sinai and gave it back. It wasn't Israeli territory. You can make the same argument about the Golan. Five Israeli prime ministers have been ready to give up all of the Golan Heights in Syria. Israel unilaterally withdrew from Lebanon and agreed with Jordan. But the West Bank is contested territory because from the Jewish point of view, this was the land of the Bible. This is the land that God gave to Israel. This was the promised land that Moses was shown by God before he died and told that he couldn't cross over and enter into it. And so it wasn't Tel Aviv of biblical times. It was Judea and Samaria. It was the West Bank. And so all the names of those places in the West Bank are names from the Bible. So the Israelis, as a Jewish state, feel, you know, a particular attachment to that area. Some of them, the right-wingers, the national religious and so on, believe that it's God gave it to them and therefore it's theirs. Palestinians feel equally strongly. They're the residents. They've lived there for centuries in some cases. And they also regard the land that Israel is on as their birthright. But they've come to accept, at least the leadership has, that they would take the West Bank and Gaza and accept that Israel would exist in peace on the rest of that territory. But at heart, it's a real estate dispute over the same piece of land where two national movements are seeking the same piece of land. That makes it a hell of a lot more complicated than the state-to-state conflict between Israel and its Arab state neighbors, where the territory that Israel occupied in 1967 is in dispute, but not the territory that Israel was created on in 1948.
And Ambassador Indyk, it seems that the territorial dispute between Israel and Palestine has been at a stalemate for decades. And even as that stalemate is occurring, we have seen drastic improvements in the relationship between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors. We saw, as you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, the 2020 Abraham Accords and succeeding normalization agreements with other Muslim nations. We saw recently that Israel and the UAE finalized a historic free trade agreement, and also Israel recently hosted the Negev summit with, I think, four Arab foreign ministers as well for the first time in a long time. So what are the economic and geopolitical driving factors behind this rapprochement?
Well, in one sense, it was precisely what Kissinger predicted 40 years earlier, that eventually they would grow tired and exhausted and decide it's not worth it anymore. Let's just make peace and get on with living together. And that was precisely the words that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of Abu Dhabi used when explaining why he had decided to normalize relations with Israel. He said, "We've grown tired of the conflict." But in another sense, it was the product of, as you imply, geostrategic circumstances. Israel had become accepted in the neighborhood essentially because of the Israel-Egypt and Israel-Jordan peace treaties. The other Arabs leave aside the Palestinians, Syrians, Lebanese, but the other Arabs, particularly in the Gulf, but also in North Africa, didn't have a border with Israel. We're not engaged in the recent conflicts with Israel. They were, some of them were involved in the original War of Independence. They were in a, you know, they didn't recognize Israel, but they were not in a state of war with Israel. They lost no territory to Israel. And the only reason why they weren't normalizing relations with Israel much earlier was because of the Palestinians and the feeling in the Arab world that before they could make peace with Israel, there needed to be a resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And that became the Arab consensus position as expressed in the Arab League Peace Initiative, in which all of the Arab states agreed that they would end their conflict and make peace with Israel, normalize relations, when Israel resolved its conflict with the Palestinians, leading to the establishment of an independent Palestinian state based on the 1967 lines with East Jerusalem as its capital. That became the consensus Arab position. It was an offer of peace to Israel, but it was contingent on a settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And essentially, they stepped back and waited. They didn't engage in trying to help Israel and the Palestinians make peace. They left that to the United States. And instead said, okay, we're ready whenever you guys solve your problem. And that's the way it lasted for, I don't know, 20 years it went on like this, with no real progress in relations between Israel and the Arab states until Iran came along. And Iran, after the revolution in, what was it, 1977, I'm confused. Anyway, back then in the late 1970s, the Iranian revolution brought to power a fundamentalist religious revolutionary state determined to not just get rid of the Shah and all the vestiges of his power, but to spread its Shiite fundamentalist ideology to the Sunni Arab world and seek a position of hegemony in the Arab Middle East. And that was deeply threatening to the Sunni Arab regimes. Many of them had large Shia populations. Some of them, like Iraq, had majority Shia populations, or Lebanon. But there were Shia populations in most of the Arab countries, and the Iranians systematically sought to use their relationships with the Shias to subvert the rule of these Sunni Arab regimes. And they, at the same time, threatened Israel and declared that their intention was to destroy Israel, and supported a range of terrorist groups, particularly Palestine Islamic Jihad, but also Hezbollah in Lebanon, with the purpose of trying to advance the conflict with Israel, and at the same time tried to develop a nuclear weapons program that would give it greater ability to take on Israel or the Arab states. And that rise of a revolutionary hegemonic Iran posed a threat both to Israel and the Sunni Arab states. So while they're all waiting for Israel and the Palestinians to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that's going nowhere, in the meantime, they're facing a common threat. And eventually, the common threat from Iran took precedence over their fealty to Palestinian nationalism. And as a result, you got this normalization of relations. Long before the formal normalization, there were strategic security relations being established between Israel and the Arab states that felt most threatened by Iran, particularly the UAE and also Saudi Arabia, although that was under the radar, under the table, and not as obvious.
And before I ask you the last couple of questions, I want to follow up on that last point about the decoupling of the Palestinian territorial claims from normalization with Israel. What does that mean for Palestine and the peace process? What does it mean that Arab states, specifically the Gulf states, are now normalizing and improving relations with Israel, even though we have not seen progress in the Israeli-Palestine peace?
So in the first instance, it dramatically weakens the Palestinian leverage on Israel, because the promise of peace with the whole Arab world was supposed to be an incentive for Israel to make peace with the Palestinians. Now that Israel can normalize relations with Arab states in advance of a Palestinian settlement, the Palestinians have essentially lost that card. Now, they haven't lost it entirely, because there's still Saudi Arabia and some other Arab states that haven't normalized. So Saudi Arabia is the kind of big prize here. And they're saying they're not going to normalize with Israel until and unless there's a settlement, or at least progress towards a settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which would lead to a Palestinian state with Jerusalem, and East Jerusalem as its capital. So they haven't lost it entirely, but they've lost a lot of leverage. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was head leader of Israel at the time of the normalization with the UAE, Bahrain, and Morocco, said to his people there, you see, we can have peace with the Arabs without having to make any concession to the Palestinians, and made it look as if, you know, Israel no longer had any intentions of doing anything towards the Palestinians. And, you know, that worked fairly well for the three countries that had decided to normalize with Israel. They went ahead, they warmed up their relations, they engaged in commerce and a whole range of joint ventures. And also they took their defense relationships out of the closet and made them formal. The Israeli defense minister visited Morocco and Bahrain and basically signed defense agreements, open, overt defense agreements between Israel and these Arab countries. But Saudi Arabia has not followed. It's sticking to its guns in terms of wanting progress on the Palestinian issue. And what has happened instead is very interesting and unexpected, is that the Abraham Accords gave Egypt and Jordan cover and incentive to warm up their relations with Israel. They had maintained peace, but cold peace with Israel, because their populations objected to the fact that they were making peace without a solution to the Palestinian problem. So they were very wary in their relationship. Now the other Arabs have normalized relations. That gives them cover, whereas before they were kind of ostracized by the rest of the Arab world. Now they had political cover. And it gave them incentive, because they didn't want to miss out on all the goodies that were accruing to the Arab states that have mobilized in Israel. So, and of course, they also were concerned about Iran. So therefore, rather than Saudi Arabia walking in the door, Egypt and Jordan walked in the door. And they came in, you mentioned the Negev summit, there were four Arab foreign ministers present and the US Secretary of State. The fourth Arab foreign minister was the Egyptian foreign minister. And even though Egypt had made peace with Israel 40 years before, his presence there gave the whole Abraham Accords axis weight, Egypt's weight. But what the Egyptians brought into the room was the Palestinian issue. And at the same time, the Egyptians have been moving into Gaza to play a kind of custodian role with the Palestinians in Gaza to try to keep things calm there and improve the situation on the ground, which the Israelis are cooperating with. And Jordan is now beginning to do the same in the West Bank. And so this means two things, that the Israelis now no longer argue that we can have peace with the Arabs without doing anything for the Palestinians. They recognize they have to do something, especially to get Saudi Arabia, which they really want. And the Egyptians and Jordanians, in terms of better relationship for Israel with its original peace partners, also depends on the Palestinians. So now we've got a situation where Egypt, Jordan, and potentially Saudi Arabia can work with Israel and the Palestinians in a way that they've refused before, to try to create better circumstances for resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, with Egypt as an anchor in Gaza and Jordan as an anchor in the West Bank, becomes easier for the Palestinians to make the kinds of concessions or security arrangements or so on that would satisfy Israel, and gives Israel an incentive, a very direct incentive, with the potential for an even bigger incentive from Saudi Arabia to move ahead with the Palestinians. But last point on this is that the process that is underway now is a Kissingerian incremental step-by-step process rather than the effort to jump to a final status negotiation and resolve all the problems. There's a recognition on both sides that we can't get there from here. And we have to rebuild trust, rebuild confidence on both sides and the intentions of the other, and rebuild it in a way that has Arab state engagement, not just endorsement, but engagement that will help the Palestinians and make it easier for the Israelis to make the ultimate deal with them.
So Ambassador Indyk, for our last question, it seems that on one side, the political and economic incentives are slowly but surely lining up for there to be more trust and more cooperation in the region. And then on the other side, the trust and cooperation is also being driven by the threat of the rise of Iran. I wanted to ask you, looking forward, you talk a lot in your book, Master of the Game, about Kissinger's excellent strategy of negotiating in the Middle East, which, as you just mentioned, we're seeing it, this step-by-step approach to the situation. So what recommendations would you give students and future policymakers, perhaps, you know, the future U.S. ambassador to Israel, studying students studying the Arab-Israeli conflict today, and how should they adapt Kissinger's style back in 1973 to the geopolitics, the dynamics, and the problems that the region is seeing today?
Yeah. Well, I didn't set out to write this particular book. I thought that I was going to write a book about how Kissinger made peace. But what I discovered along the way was his skepticism about peace and his understanding that before you could make peace, you have to have an order, a stable order in the region. The people who came after Kissinger, including me, knew not Kissinger. We didn't understand the need for a cautious, skeptical, incremental approach. We swung for the fences. We tried for the ultimate agreements. And in some cases, we succeeded, Egypt and Jordan. But in the case of the Palestinians, we failed, and we failed spectacularly, and we failed repeatedly from administration to administration, because we were constantly trying to end the conflict. So that's the first lesson I would say, is that in some cases, not in all cases, in some cases, it's important to have doubt It's the, what I call the benefit of doubt. That one should temper one's enthusiasm for peacemaking, which is a natural tendency for Americans across the board. We want to remake the world because we have this immense power. We want to remake the world in our own image as a more free place, more democratic place, more peaceful place. But we need to do it in a cautious way. As a general rule, we need to be careful about it. First of all, not to squander our own influence and reputation, as we did in the Middle East. But also because if we're not cautious, instead of achieving peace, we can cause wars. And that results in immense damage and loss of life. So we start with a sense of caution and an understanding of the need for order and stability as a precursor to peacemaking. But as I point out in the book, that's not enough. Kissinger missed opportunities to avoid war before 1973, and I explain how Sadat wanted to make peace and essentially went to war in order to make peace because the United States, and Kissinger in particular, wouldn't take him seriously. And after the 1973 war, I show that he could have had peace between Israel and Egypt on his watch. You know, at the end of my, I had many interviews with him, but at the end, I asked him whether he ever regretted not making the peace between Israel and Egypt that Jimmy Carter got 2 years later. And he said, no. He said, if I'd been Secretary of State after the elections, if Ford had been elected and I'd been reappointed, I would have pursued a non-belligerency agreement. I wouldn't have pursued a peace agreement. And I said, why? He said, because I was always afraid that if I pushed too hard, I would break it. And you see, that's exactly what we did at Camp David. And I was part of that effort in the second Camp David effort in 2000. We dragged Arafat to Camp David on Ehud Barak, who was Prime Minister of Israel's insistence. And he wasn't ready. And it failed. And when it failed, the whole thing blew up in our faces. Thousands of people killed on both sides, and were maimed and casualties, and all of the trust destroyed, and we haven't been able to rebuild that trust and confidence in a meaningful negotiation ever since. So that's the cautionary part of the term. But it needs to be mixed with having your radar tuned always to the potential for opportunities where the parties themselves actually are telling you they're ready. And if they really are ready and you're willing to test the proposition, if they are, then the United States needs to go for it. And go for it in the way Jimmy Carter went for, Kissinger went for the disengagement agreements that he negotiated with an intensity and a commitment that can actually drive it through to an agreement. So it's a mixed tale. Above all, it requires American diplomats to be sensitive, be able to listen, not just talk, to try to understand what motivates. This was one of Kissinger's great skills, and his understanding of the psychological motivation of the leaders he was dealing with. And then, once you understand where they're coming from, figure out how to apply leverage, both pressure and reward, carrots and stick, to move parties to the point where they would take risks supported by the United States, underwritten by the United States, that could lead to breakthroughs to peace. He's making a very risky business, but that's also an essential part of the US role, American diplomats' role, is to provide the reassurance and the safety for countries, for leaders to do things that are risky, dangerous propositions.
And with that, Ambassador Martin Indyk, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.